Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains mentions including COVID, despair, and difficulties and pressure exerted upon individuals and society as a whole, as well as a fairly objectifying stance towards women, as we've been seeing with most of Catch-22. Also, there is moaning. You heard me.
Hey, hey, folks. Dave here.
And Rue.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us this week as we continue with Catch-22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 21, General Dreidel. So this might be in a series of chapters talking about the more negative characters of the book. We've had Colonel Cathcart, General Whitcomb, Corporal Whitcomb, and now, well, General Dreidel is supposed to be the good one, but being a general in this outfit does not give me confidence to his overall character.
No. It's going to be a pain, I think. And sometimes we know that when a chapter is about one person, it's not actually about them. It's about someone else.
That's very true. The chaplain was a huge part of the last two chapters.
Yes.
So was Colonel Korn.
Yes. So now we continue our journey with all these dudes who are a pain. I've just been having bureaucratic nonsense all month, I swear, and so therefore I'm particularly sensitive to this book.
you're not in the right frame of mind to have to deal with the BS of fictional bureaucracy.
Let alone, yeah, the real one is already rough enough. I'm like, get out of here. Oh, well, tis the way it is. It didn't have to be this way, and yet it is. Hey.
Not that you're bitter.
No. I'm like, I'm tired. That's what I am. I'm very tired.
I'm fairly tired myself today, and I don't know why. I slept well. Well, actually, no. I slept a long time, but I didn't sleep well.
Well, the weather was a bit wonky, which, back to our universal topic of weather. No, the weather was a bit wonky last night as well, and we're shuffling towards spring, which just means unstable weather systems, more so than usual. I don't know, something is up, but there's also a lot of pressure going on right now in terms of, there's a lot of social pressure, there's a lot of risk of COVID, there's a lot of finger pointing, there's a lot of lack of accountability. So it's just been, I mean, it has been over a year and a half of this kind of ongoing saga of people not pulling up their socks and just doing what's beneficial for everyone.
And the utter failure of those people in charge.
Well, that's what I mean. People not taking responsibility for their jobs. Like, responsibility. There's a lack of accountability and responsibility, and that's kind of sad. I mean, there's some people who have really done what they could do to contribute to the the world, so to speak, but there's also people who've just been a pain. A pain, I say.
And there's been, on the other side as well, people purposely sowing discord.
Yes, those are also not the most helpful things.
Yeah, and just as a random human on this rock, I have been, I'll call it despair, has been piling up. The level of personal stress and worry about the state of the world and my lack of movement through it, and whether what the future holds, that's been steadily rising over time. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. Our world situation has not been the best, and perhaps many of you are not where you want to be either.
I think that's part of it, but it's also, yeah, like there is an increasing sense of frustration and hopelessness, and that can really affect you as a person. And I mean, all of us none of us are immune to it. We're all affected in some way by it, whether directly or indirectly. I think that the challenge is to be able to, how do I phrase it? Is to review what your values are and how you live by them, rather than focusing on, I guess, accomplishments as measured by external standards or what is prescribed as an accomplishment. I'm not sure if I'm making sense, but it's this, this is a personal opinion, obviously, but I reckon that anyone who has values and integrity and tries to live the best that they can and make a difference in people's lives, whatever that is and however that looks to them, we might not know what the difference is in another person's life, but as long as we kind of evaluate and review, did I behave in a way that was considerate and compassionate and all the values that are, you know, laudable, that are praiseworthy, did I live by those values that I want to see in myself and I would like to encourage in others? Yes. Okay. That's an accomplishment. It's less the, I guess, the less the pieces of paper and, I mean, of course, look, if you finish a degree, awesome. Excellent. Good. It's a representation of good hard work. But it's what drives that good hard work. It's what drives why you do things that is oftentimes, I think, more important than necessary, and the outcome of it necessarily than someone else recognizing what it is. Of course, this is an ideal situation, and it's not including the fact that we have to navigate a world where those external labels and value statements about us are used to judge us. That's a different thing. But we're not responsible for the judgment of others. We're only responsible for our actions and attitudes and behavior. And of course, the impact that has on others, but that's not the same as someone else making a judgment about you.
Hmm.
I don't know. It's windy, but I think that's one way to also retain hope, is that the hope is more and more people recognize their own, and we can encourage each other to recognize our own way of contributing, whatever that might look like, to a world that we would like to live in, that we would all like to live in. Even if it's, I don't know. We've said this before. Even if you're courteous to someone, and whether they recognize it and appreciate it or not is not important, you remain courteous, and maybe that one in 20 people that you say good morning to and mean it, or let that car merge, let them into the traffic, or let a pedestrian cross, even though they weren't quite at the zebra crossing, but you know that you knew that they were coming, so you slowed down, you let them cross. That it's the helping the old lady with their groceries kind of example, but that those little things, I think you've said it before as well, all those little things, they count. It's not that someone's sitting there making a tally of it. It's just that it's those little things that make the world livable and worth living in.
Hmm. And what yeah. is it about driving that makes us all so angry? The slightest slight.
Driving's hilarious. I sometimes I'm on the phone with a friend when she's driving in Sydney, and
The angriest I have ever been in my life has always been behind the wheel of a car.
Yeah, but that's because you're conscious that, well, I think those of us who are conscious that we are driving around in a vehicle that could harm others, we have a sense of responsibility. And so when you see someone driving in a way that we perceive as irresponsible or endangering others, of course you're going to get mad. You're like, what the heck, man?
And I would like to take this opportunity to point out that, yes, I do consider myself to be a good driver, yet everybody considers themselves to be a good driver. And when I'm out on the road, the evidence does not support that claim.
Yeah, I think everyone, maybe that's another one. It's like everyone thinks that they're doing well, but they're actually not necessarily, because some of them will just be really strict and really stick to absolutely every rule as written, every dot, every, but it doesn't take into account the reality of a situation. Like, for example, if half the road is flooded, people are not going to drive the same way as though there were two clear lanes.
Have to remind myself when it's like really belting down not to get mad at people going under the speed limit, because usually I'm going under the speed limit when it's raining.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Like we know that we need to, there's reasonable, that's why the law generally has, at least in Australia, we have a statement of the reasonable person. So what would the reasonable person do on the circumstances, and was it what a reasonable, so it's a thing. Not reasonable doubt, reasonable person in this case.
I do also have a theory about the idea that when we're driving, we see the car rather than the people driving the car. So we see it as basically these autonomous hunks of metal that are intruding upon our own personal metal space.
I wonder if it's a bit of that. I think there's other reasons. Like there's also this idea of, like, say you're driving. I think the why we're driving can make a difference as well. If you're on your way to a doctor's appointment and you're worried about it.
Yeah. Every time I've driven to a job interview. Anxiety. But I don't know.
Generally, people's tolerance for other people's behavior and patterns and habits of driving tends to drop.
This might be a personal thing, but it also seems like half the problem from my perspective is that so many drivers seem oblivious to paying attention to the road. I think the idea of, for most folks, driving is that daily commute. Not only does it become routine, but it, one thing I've been reading a lot of since the pandemic's been winding down around the world, where a lot of businesses are trying to force their employees to go back to normal.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of discussion about getting people back in the office.
Yeah.
And the pushback against that. And one of the big reasons is so many folks had just such horrendous commutes every day, anywhere from 30 minutes to 3 hours out of their day spent traveling to and from their job. And the fact they don't have that anymore has just freed so much of their lives up that, like, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, there's that. And also the it's cheaper for most companies for their employees not to be working in their offices.
Well, one of the reasons that folks think there's been such a push is the cost of renting those huge office spaces. They need to validate that to themselves.
Oh, for sure. And that's the thing. We could be doing this completely differently. Yes, you could. Your employees also might not have to work as many hours as what you are making them work, and they could get the job done and in the comfort of their own home. If you remunerate them appropriately, then you can retain employees. If you don't, you can't.
That is one thing where more and more companies are allowing a work from home system. So companies that aren't see their employees jumping ship. There is, at least this is all anecdotal from reading personal stories on the internet, but it is
looking like that. Yeah. It is. It's that if you don't appropriately compensate, if you don't pay attention to employee safety, if you don't take into consideration how the workplace adapts, they're going to have to adapt mainly also because we're going to have a whole bunch of people who physically cannot commute anymore or physically can't necessarily come into work, because the fact that COVID was and is so widespread, the impact that is going to have in terms of chronic complications with a whole chunk of the population, and the thing is, the ratio of people who are having these long-term issues is not greater than with other infectious diseases so far. So far, the data suggests. I mean, we will find out over time.
Mm.
But so far, it looks about the same.
Well, that's the other thing we have to... Sorry to jump on you, but keep in mind that this pandemic, what COVID is, what we... I think I first heard about maybe December 2019. It's like a little over a year and a half old, really.
Yeah. We are yet to find out a whole bunch of things. Mm. I said the tail end of this condition, the tail end of this particular disease is going to be long. It's going to be a very long tale. We're talking about 80 years or so of things we're going to figure out. Oh, wait, that's when did this start? Oh, all these people were exposed to COVID. Oh, so that's why they've all got XYZ. So like, it's going to be a thing.
Like the mad cow disease thing, how that was dormant for so long. And then suddenly a huge population started showing symptoms of such a thing.
Yep. So we're going to have a lot of that. So because as the people who like to say, but it's not as lethal as, it's not as lethal as a lot of things. It is more lethal, arguably, than the flu. It is more lethal than the flu. Depends on where you are. Depends on the population, depends on the age, but it's pretty lethal. The problem is that it's across the board more dangerous. It is also highly infectious. It is more infectious than the flu. And that was the problem. And these new variants even worse. Yeah.
Well, these new variants seem very nasty. I mean, COVID's already nasty, but...
Yeah, it's even more nasty. But the point is that we've got all this going on.
Sorry, in my mind, the phrase just popped up, vanilla COVID.
Yes, so essentially going through the Greek alphabet of different COVIDs, that strains or variants that are emerging, and it's nasty. And all the previous SARS, because that's what it is. All the previous coronaviruses have a similar post. So they have this post-infectious tail. Other infectious diseases do as well, but this one is behaving the post-infectious, the long-term issues. We are not surprised that this is happening because this is something they recognized way back in the mid-2000s and early 2000s with SARS. Aside from the PTSD that all our healthcare and quote-unquote essential staff are going through. They're now, even if you look on Twitter now, all the healthcare staff are like, oh God, we're starting to see it happen again. I don't know if I can go through another round of this. Like they are struggling. And even the ones in Australia where we haven't had that many cases, but already we are struggling. We are the people particularly in the ICUs and they are stretched emotionally, physically, mentally. Yeah.
I heard stories from the U.S. of very, basically very experienced doctors and nurses when this first hit. They're like, you know what? I'm just going to cash out retirement. I don't want to deal with
A lot of people have, and they've been treating the nurses. There's a whole nother thing. They've not been treating the nurses well. They've been kind of recruiting from whoever and whatever they can get, and they're starting to hit the dredges, and there's a problem with that because they mistreat them and then they leave and then they're stuck again. It's a whole mess. And they're also risking their lives whilst they're at it, because a lot of the time they're not offered the option of vaccination. Australia has a big problem with that right now because of the pool that we have in terms of available vaccines.
That failure of leadership I talked about earlier.
It's accountability. It's a lack of accountability and responsibility.
I don't want to say leadership. I tried to avoid the word leader before because I don't think the people in charge are leading. They're not leaders.
No, leading involves accountability. We had a discussion about leadership. The concept of leadership is very conflated with power. And that's not actually helpful. It doesn't advance us as a civilization in any which way. But yeah, so I've been looking at these things and we're going to deal with this tail end, but also it means that we're going to have an increasing population that will need to work from home, an increasing qualified population where they physically cannot do what they used to be able to do. And I mean, we don't know how long it's going to last. Some may recover. In fact, usually with ME, with myelencephalitis, if that's a comparable, myalgic encephalitis, the approximate ratio is 25% pretty much recover. It takes time. It can take effort. It can be spontaneous. We don't know. There's some of it that's a bit mysterious. If we use that as our measure for probably with long COVID, what's going to probably happen. Again, we're in relatively new territory, but we have other situations that are similar and can inform our estimates, so to speak. There's a lot of misinformation. There's people remarkably incorrect, and that's getting used to determine policy, even though it is completely unfounded and incorrect. particularly in some countries. UK is one that comes to mind, and it's causing issues. It's causing issues for the patients. It's causing issues for the clinicians. It's a mess. And the point is that with all this going on, workplaces are going to have to adapt. Like any place that doesn't adapt, because of the way that our economies are designed, if you don't adapt, the free market chews you up and spits you out.
Ideally, that's the case.
But... No, but now it is the case because the population is at a point. I mean, if anyone has had an opportunity to have a look at what's going on in South Africa, it's, yeah, they already were having problems with unemployment and economic instability. COVID came along, completely broke down a whole bunch of systems, and now it's chaos. And some places are fine. Some people are fine. But for the vast majority of the population, there's an ever-increasing wave of chaos because there's a lack of responsibility, accountability, and adaptability to the situation. You can't just throw logs into the fire that is the economy and hope that it'll all work out. It doesn't correct itself that way. It's when your logs decide that they don't want to burn there, but they're going to burn wherever the hell they want, then you're in trouble. So yes, cautionary tales. And now we look at the cautionary chaotic tale that is Catch-22. Oh my gosh.
Don't be Corporal Whitcomb. That's what I took away from last week.
Don't be any of these people. I mean, the chaplain needs to grow a spine.
Yeah.
But I think he's so afraid of hurting people's feelings and...
Well, he's also afraid of people.
He's afraid, full stop, yeah. That's not helpful. He's genuine. He does want to help, but he lacks the necessary spine.
Fortitude.
Yeah. Yeah. To be able to handle this. It's. I mean, considering the people we're talking about between Korn and Cathcart and Black and all of them, they're nasty.
And to have his own assistant be that awful.
His own assistant is manipulating the situation on top of everything else. And it was deliberate. They picked someone that would react that way.
Ah.
Because remember, Korn picked it and insisted. Like they don't like the chaplain because he probably would actually speak up for people.
Or reminds them of their own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Or their lack of spirituality.
Or their, well, I didn't even say their lack of morality, but yeah.
Mm. Another M word.
Yes, all the M words.
So we shall get started because it looks like this chapter is going to be a long one. We'll do our best to power through.
Yes.
Chapter 21, General Dreedle. Colonel Cathcart was not thinking anything at all about the chaplain, but was tangled up in a brand new menacing problem of his own. Yossarian. Yossarian. The mere sound of that execrable, ugly name made his blood run cold and his breath come in labored gasps. The chaplain's first mention of the name Yossarian had tolled deep in his memory like a portentous gong. As soon as the latch of the door had clicked shut, the whole humiliating recollection of the naked man in formation came cascading down upon him in a mortifying, choking flood of stinging details. He began to perspire and tremble. There was a sinister and unlikely coincidence exposed that was too diabolical in implication to be anything less than the most hideous of omens. The name of the man who had stood naked in ranks that day to receive his distinguished flying cross from General Dreedle had also been Yossarian. And now it was a man named Yossarian who was threatening to make trouble over the 60 missions he had just ordered the men in his group to fly. Colonel Cathcart wondered gloomily if it was the same Yossarian. Well, I want to interject, just how many people do you know named Yossarian?
Exactly. Far out.
But before reading Catch-22, I have never heard that name before.
Probably not, but... There's some of them sometimes show up, like the names, I know similar names.
Mm.
Usually I would associate that kind of name with, rather than Assyrian, I would have thought he was Armenian.
Ah.
Because it's similar.
Mm.
That very end, at the end is, yeah.
He climbed to his feet with an air of intolerable woe and began moving about his office. He felt himself in the presence of the mysterious. The naked man in formation, he conceded cheerlessly, had been a real black eye for him. So had the tampering with the bomb line before the mission to Bologna and the 7-day delay in destroying the bridge at Ferrara. Even though destroying the bridge at Ferrara, finally, he remembered with glee, had been a real feather in his cap. Although losing a plane there the second time around, he recalled in dejection, had been another black eye. Even though he had won another real feather in his cap by getting a medal approved for the bombardier who had gotten him the real black eye in the first place by going around over the target twice. That bombardier's name, he remembered suddenly with another stupefying shock, had also been Yessarian. Now there were three. His viscous eyes bulged with astonishment, and he whipped himself around in alarm to see what was taking place behind him. A moment ago, there had been no Yessarians in his life. Now they were multiplying like hobgoblins. He tried to make himself grow calm. Yessarian was not a common name. Perhaps there were not really three Yessarians, but only two Yessarians, or maybe even only one Yessarian. But that really made no difference. The colonel was still in grave peril. Intuition warned him that he was drawing close to some immense and inscrutable cosmic climax, and his broad, meaty, towering frame tingled from head to toe at the thought that Yessarian, whoever he would eventually turn out to be, was destined to serve as his nemesis. Colonel Cathcart was not superstitious, but he did believe in omens, and he sat right back down behind his desk and made a cryptic notation on his memorandum pad to look into the whole suspicious business of the Yessarians right away. He wrote his reminder to himself in a heavy and decisive hand, amplifying it sharply with a series of coded punctuation marks and underlining the whole message twice so that it read, Yessarian, !! Brackets, !! The colonel sat back when he had finished and was extremely pleased with himself for the prompt action he had just taken to meet this sinister crisis. Yessarian, the very sight of the name made him shudder. There were so many S's in it. It just had to be subversive. It was like the word subversive itself. It was like seditious and insidious too, and like socialist, suspicious, fascist, and communist. It was an odious, alien, distasteful name that just did not inspire confidence. It was not at all like such clean, crisp, honest American names as Cathcart, Peckham, and Dreidel. Aside, it slips out a bit when I'm reading or talking, but I grew up with a really bad lisp, and I worked on it very hard through speech therapy when I was a child, but mostly when I was a teenager. And I remember in high school, a friend of mine going, what awful person made the word to explain that condition have an S in it?
That's true. So wrong. Oh, dear.
Colonel Cathcart rose slowly and began drifting about his office again. Almost unconsciously, he picked up a plum tomato from the top of one of the bushels and took a voracious bite. He made a wry face at once and threw the rest of the plum tomato into his wastebasket. The colonel did not like plum tomatoes, not even when they were his own, and these were not even his own. These had been purchased in different marketplaces all over Pianosa by Colonel Korn under various identities, moved up to the colonel's farmhouse in the hills in the dead of night, and transported down to group headquarters the next morning for sale to Milo, who paid Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn premium prices for them. Colonel Cathcart often wondered if what they were doing with the plum tomatoes was legal, but Colonel Korn said it was, and he tried not to brood about it too often. He had no way of knowing whether or not the house in the hills was legal either, since Colonel Korn had made all the arrangements. Colonel Cathcart did not know if he owned the house or rented it, from whom he had acquired it, or how much, if anything, it was costing. Colonel Korn was the lawyer, and if Colonel Korn assured him that fraud, extortion, currency manipulation, embezzlement, income tax evasion, and black market speculations were legal, Colonel Cathcart was in no position to disagree with him.
Wow.
All Colonel Cathcart knew about his house in the hills was that he had such a house and hated it. He was never so bored as when spending there the 2 or 3 days every other week necessary to sustain the illusion that his damp and drafty stone farmhouse in the hills was a golden palace of carnal delights. Officers' clubs everywhere pulsated with blurred but knowing accounts of lavish, hushed-up drinking and sex orgies there, and of secret, intimate nights of ecstasy with the most beautiful, the most tantalizing, the most readily aroused, and most easily satisfied Italian courtesans, film actresses, models, and countesses. No such private nights of ecstasy or hushed-up drinking and sex orgies ever occurred. They might have occurred if either General Dreidel or General Peckham had once evinced an interest in taking part in orgies with him, but neither ever did, and the colonel was certainly not going to waste his time and energy making love to beautiful women unless there was something in it for him.
I see.
Ah, boy. It's just...
So ambitious. It's silly.
The real idea of so worried about future you can't appreciate the moment.
Oh, yeah. But also, if it doesn't contribute to the future, then what's the point?
Yeah, yeah. I can't have pleasure just because it's pleasurable. There has to be a purpose to it.
Well, look. I understand purposefulness, that's fine. But his purpose is, I will only do the thing if it is something that those two who can help me advance show an interest in. Otherwise, anything I do, it has to be only for the purpose of them wanting to advance me. In the meantime, Colonel Korn is completely using him.
Yes. Colonel Cathcart will be his fall guy when this all goes to crap.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So.
The colonel dreaded his dank, lonely nights at his farmhouse and the dull, uneventful days. He had much more fun back at group, browbeating everyone he wasn't afraid of. However, as Colonel Korn kept reminding him, there was not much glamour in having a farmhouse in the hills if he never used it. He drove off to his farmhouse each time in a mood of self-pity. He carried a shotgun in his jeep and spent the monotonous hours there shooting it at birds and at the plum tomatoes that did grow there in untended rows and were too much trouble to harvest. Among those officers of inferior rank toward whom Colonel Cathcart still deemed it prudent to show respect, he included Major de Coverley, even though he did not want to and was not sure he even had to. Major de Coverley was as great a mystery to him as he was to Major Major, and to everyone else who ever took notice of him. Colonel Cathcart had no idea whether to look up or look down in his attitude toward Major de Coverley. Major de Coverley was only a major, even though he was ages older than Colonel Cathcart. At the same time, so many other people treated Major de Coverley with such profound and fearful veneration that Colonel Cathcart had a hunch they might know something.
So because everyone else is intimidated by him, he's like, oh, I should probably be intimidated by him as well. Wow.
Major de Coverley was an ominous, incomprehensible presence who kept him constantly on edge and of whom even Colonel Korn tended to be wary. Everyone was afraid of him, and no one knew why. No one even knew Major de Coverley's first name, because no one had ever had the temerity to ask him. Colonel Cathcart knew that Major de Coverley was away, and he rejoiced in his absence until it occurred to him that Major de Coverley might be away somewhere conspiring against him. And then he wished that Major de Coverley were back in his squadron where he belonged so that he could be watched.
He's paranoid, like severely paranoid. He's worse than the other guy, the intelligence officer.
Wintergreen?
No. The intelligence officer, the spy, basically. This
the CID man?
No, the guy who was basically saying that the behavior in Germany was American kind of values.
Oh, that was Captain Black.
Yes, so Captain Black. He's worse than Captain Black in terms of his paranoia.
Yeah.
He's worse than than Ysarion. because technically Ysarion's not wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Oof. In a little while, Colonel Cathcart's arches began to ache from pacing back and forth so much. He sat down behind his desk again and resolved to embark upon a mature and systematic evaluation of the entire military situation. With the businesslike air of a man who knows how to get things done, he found a large white pad, drew a straight line down the middle, and crossed it near the top, dividing the page into two blank columns of equal width. He rested a moment in critical rumination. Then he huddled over his desk, and at the head of the left column, in a cramped and finicky hand, he wrote, "Black eyes," with 3 exclamation marks. At the top of the right column, he wrote, "Feathers in my cap," 3 exclamation marks, followed by 2 exclamation marks. He leaned back once more to inspect his chart admiringly from an objective perspective. After a few seconds of solemn deliberation, he licked the tip of his pencil carefully and wrote under black eyes, after intent intervals, "Ferrera, Bologna, bomb line moved on map during, skeet range, naked man in formation after Avignon." Then he added, "Food poisoning during Bologna," and "Moaning, epidemic of during Avignon briefing." Then he added, "Chaplain, hanging around officers' club every night." He decided to be charitable about the chaplain, even though he did not like him, and under "feathers in my cap," he wrote, "Chaplain, hanging around officers' club every night." The two chaplain entries, therefore, neutralized each other. Alongside Ferrera and naked man in formation after Avignon, then he wrote Ysarion. Alongside Bologna, bomb line moved on map during, food poisoning during Bologna, and moaning, epidemic of during Avignon briefing, he wrote in a bold, decisive hand, a question mark. Those entries labeled question mark were the ones he wanted to investigate immediately to determine if Ysarion had played any part in them. Ysarion did move the bomb line, didn't he?
Yeah, but no one knows about that.
Suddenly, his arm began to shake, and he was unable to write anymore.
Quick amendment. No one alive knows about that.
Yep. Also, I'm just thinking this might be a good cipher for those trying to keep a timeline, because he's writing down events, good and bad, at this point that have happened.
Well, these are all the things that he considers bad.
And good.
Yeah, well, this is a bad so far. He hasn't mentioned good yet.
Yeah, because that's when he wrote the second chaplain entry, under "feathers in my cap."
He's written one thing in the good column and a few things.
Suddenly,
no, that's it. That's it. That's the only positive thing he's written.
Suddenly, his arm began to shake, and he was unable to write anymore. He rose to his feet in terror, feeling sticky and fat, and rushed to the open window to gulp in fresh air. His gaze fell on the skeet range, and he reeled away with a sharp cry of distress, his wild and feverish eyes scanning the walls of his office frantically, as though they were swarming with the Ysarians. Nobody loved him. General Dreidel hated him, although General Peckham liked him, although he couldn't be sure, since Colonel Cargill, General Peckham's aide, undoubtedly had ambitions of his own and was probably sabotaging him with General Peckham at every opportunity. The only good colonel, he decided, was a dead colonel, except for himself. The only colonel he trusted was Colonel Moodus, and even he had an in with his father-in-law. Milo, of course, had been the big feather in his cap, although having his group bombed by Milo's planes had probably been a terrible black eye for him, even though Milo had ultimately stilled all protest by disclosing the huge net profit the syndicate had realized on the deal with the enemy and convincing everyone that bombing his own men and planes had therefore really been a commendable and very lucrative blow on the side of private enterprise. Well, hold on right there. That's new information.
Yep. Okay, so we know Milo bombing.
Like they sold information to the enemy?
Milo, no, his own syndicate bombed. That's very confusing.
But it says realized on the deal with the enemy.
Yeah, so he made a deal with the enemy.
Yeah.
For profit. But he's like he bombed his own, their own camp for profit.
maybe getting money from the enemy to do so.
That's what I'm thinking has happened. Dear. But Milo convinced them it was profitable, so therefore good. Wow. Okay.
The colonel was insecure about Milo because other colonels were trying to lure him away, and Colonel Cathcart still had that lousy big chief white half-oat in his group, who that lousy, lazy Captain Black claimed was the one really responsible for the bomb lines being moved during the big siege of Bologna. Colonel Cathcart liked Big Chief White Half-Oat because Big Chief White Half-Oat kept punching that lousy Colonel Moodus in the nose every time he got drunk and Colonel Moodus was around. He wished that Big Chief White Half-Oat would begin punching Colonel Korn in his fat face too. Colonel Korn was a lousy smart aleck. Someone at 27th Air Force Headquarters had it in for him and sent back every request he wrote with a blustering rebuke. And Colonel Korn had bribed a clever mail clerk there named Wintergreen to try to find out who it was.
Isn't it Wintergreen?
It might be.
It is. Wintergreen's the one who keeps telling, like, he keeps correcting and telling people off.
Oh, yep.
Yep, so he's bribing. Oh, wow. Okay.
Talk about corruption and nothing working properly.
Yep.
Losing the plane over Ferrara the second time around had not done him any good, he had to admit, and neither had having that other plane disappear inside that cloud. That was one he hadn't even written down. He tried to recall longingly if Yessarian had been lost in that plane in the cloud, and realized that Yessarian could not possibly have been lost in that plane in the cloud if he was still around now, raising such a big stink about having to fly a lousy 5 missions more. Maybe 60 missions were too many for the men to fly, Colonel Cathcart reasoned, if Yessarian objected to flying them, but he then remembered that forcing his men to fly more missions than everyone else was the most tangible achievement he had going for him. As Colonel Korn often remarked, the war was crawling with group commanders who were merely doing their duty, and it required just some sort of dramatic gesture, like making his group fly more combat missions than any other bomber group, to spotlight his unique qualities of leadership.
Wow. Yeah, certainly. Korn's definitely setting him up.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we're finding, yeah, like, all his ideas are coming from Colonel Korn.
Yeah.
Certainly none of the generals seemed to object to what he was doing, although as far as he could detect, they weren't particularly impressed either, which made him suspect that perhaps 60 combat missions were not nearly enough, and that he ought to increase the number at once to 70, 80, 100, or even 200, 300, or 6,000. Certainly, he would be much better off under someone suave like General Peckham than he was under somebody boorish and insensitive like General Dreidel, because General Peckham had the discernment, the intelligence, and the Ivy League background to appreciate and enjoy him at his full value, although General Peckham had never given the slightest indication that he appreciated or enjoyed him at all. Colonel Cathcart felt perceptive enough to realize that visible signals of recognition were never necessary between sophisticated, self-assured people like himself and General Peckham.
Doesn't General Peckham hate him?
Probably.
Yeah.
Colonel Cathcart felt perceptive enough to realize that visible signals of recognition were never necessary between sophisticated, self-assured people like himself and General Peckham, who could warm to each other from a distance with innate mutual understanding. It was enough that they were of like kind, and he knew it was only a matter of waiting discreetly for preferment until the right time, although it rotted Colonel Cathcart's self-esteem to observe that General Peckham never deliberately sought him out, and that he labored no harder to impress Colonel Cathcart with his epigrams and erudition than he did to impress anyone else in earshot, even enlisted men. Either Colonel Cathcart wasn't getting through to General Peckham, or General Peckham was not the scintillating, discriminating, intellectual, forward-looking personality he pretended to be, and it was really General Dreidel, who was sensitive, charming, brilliant, and sophisticated, and under whom he would certainly be much better off. And suddenly, Colonel Cathcart had absolutely no conception of how strongly he stood with anyone, and began banging on his buzzer with his fist for Colonel Korn to come running into his office and assure him that everybody loved him, that Yessarian was a figment of his imagination, and that he was making wonderful progress in the splendid and valiant campaign he was waging to become a general. Actually, Colonel Cathcart did not have a chance in hell of becoming a general. For one thing, there was ex-PFC Wintergreen, who also wanted to be a general, and who always distorted, destroyed, rejected, or misdirected any correspondence by, for, or about Colonel Cathcart that might do him credit. For another, there was already a general, General Dreidel, who knew that General Peckham was after his job, but did not know how to stop him. General Dreidel, the wing commander, was a blunt, chunky, barrel-chested man in his early 50s. His nose was squat and red, and he had lumpy white, bunched-up eyelids circling his small gray eyes like halos of bacon fat. He had a nurse and a son-in-law, and he was prone to long, ponderous silences when he had not been drinking too much. General Dreidel had wasted too much of his time in the army doing his job well, and now it was too late. Wow. Oh, that's a great line. New power alignments had coalesced without him, and he was at a loss to cope with them. At unguarded moments, his hard and sullen face slipped into a somber, preoccupied look of defeat and frustration. General Dreidel drank a great deal. His moods were arbitrary and unpredictable. War is hell, he declared frequently, drunk or sober, and he really meant it, although that did not prevent him from making a good living out of it or from taking his son-in-law into the business with him, even though the two bickered constantly. That bastard, General Dreidel would complain about his son-in-law with a contemptuous grunt to anyone who happened to be standing beside him at the curve of the bar of the officers' club. Everything he's got he owes to me. I made him, that lousy son of a bitch. He hasn't got brains enough to get ahead on his own. He thinks he knows everything, Colonel Moodus would retort in a sulking tone to his own audience at the other end of the bar. He can't take criticism, and he won't listen to advice. All he can do is give advice, General Dreidel would observe with a rasping snort. If it wasn't for me, he'd still be a corporal. General Dreidel was always accompanied by both Colonel Moodus and his nurse, who was as delectable a piece of ass as anyone who saw her had ever laid eyes upon. That's a weird description right out of nowhere.
It's not referring to Colonel... Having a moment. It's referring to the nurse.
Yeah.
No, it's just typical for that style of thinking.
Yeah, it's thrown me because even when describing the prostitutes, it didn't get that obscene, I guess, or blunt.
It's not obscene. It's objectifying. All of them are objectifying, but he's kind of depicting exactly what the mindset of this guy is.
Mm. General Dreidel's nurse was chubby, short, and blonde. She had plump, dimpled cheeks, happy blue eyes, and neat, curly, turned-up hair. She smiled at everyone and never spoke at all unless she was spoken to. Her bosom was lush and her complexion clear. She was irresistible, and men edged away from her carefully. She was succulent, sweet, docile, and dumb, and she drove everyone crazy but General Dreidel. You should see her naked, General Dreidel chortled with croupy relish, while his nurse stood smiling proudly right at his shoulder. Back at wing, she's got a uniform in my room made of purple silk that's so tight her nipples stand out like Bing cherries. Milo got me the fabric. There isn't even room enough for panties or a brassiere underneath. I make her wear it some nights when Moodus is around just to drive him crazy. General Dreidel laughed hoarsely. You should see what goes on inside that blouse of hers every time she shifts her weight. She drives him out of his mind. The first time I catch him putting a hand on her or any other woman, I'll bust the horny bastard right down to private and put him on KP for a year. He keeps her around just to drive me crazy, Colonel Moodus accused aggrievedly at the other end of the bar. Back at wing, she's got a uniform made out of purple silk that's so tight her nipples stand out like Bing cherries. There isn't even room for panties or a brassiere underneath. You should hear that rustle every time she shifts her weight. The first time I make a pass at her or any other girl, he'll bust me right down to private and put me on KP for a year. She drives me out of my mind. He hasn't gotten laid since we shipped overseas, confided General Dreidel, and his square grizzled head bobbed with sadistic laughter at the fiendish idea. That's one of the reasons I never let him out of my sight. Just so he can't get to a woman. Can you imagine what that poor son of a bitch is going through? I haven't been to bed with a woman since we shipped overseas, Colonel Moodus whimpered tearfully. Can you imagine what I'm going through? General Dreidel could be as intransigent with anyone else when displeased as he was with Colonel Moodus. He had no taste for sham, tact, or pretension, and his credo as a professional soldier was unified and concise. He believed that the young men who took orders from him should be willing to give up their lives for the ideals, aspirations, and idiosyncrasies of the old men he took orders from. The officers and enlisted men in his command had identity for him only as military quantities. All he asked was that they do their work. Beyond that, they were free to do whatever they pleased. They were free, as Colonel Cathcart was free, to force their men to fly 60 missions if they chose, and they were free, as Yessarian had been free, to stand in formation naked if they wanted to. Although General Dreidel's granite jaw swung open at the sight, and he went striding dictatorially right down the line to make certain that there really was a man wearing nothing but moccasins waiting at attention in ranks to receive a medal from him. General Dreidel was speechless. Colonel Cathcart began to faint when he spied the Assyrian, and Colonel Korn stepped up behind him and squeezed his arm in a strong grip. The silence was grotesque. A steady, warm wind flowed in from the beach, and an old cart filled with dirty straw rumbled into view on the main road, drawn by a black donkey and driven by a farmer in a flopping hat and faded brown work clothes, who paid no attention to the formal military ceremony taking place in the small field on his right. At last, General Dreidel spoke. "Get back in the car," he snapped over his shoulder to the nurse, who had followed him down the line. The nurse toddled away with a smile toward his brown staff car, parked about 20 yards away at the edge of the rectangular clearing. General Dreidel waited in austere silence until the car door slammed and then demanded, "Which one is this?" Colonel Moodus checked his roster. "This one is Yessarian, Dad. He gets a Distinguished Flying Cross." "Well, I'll be damned," mumbled General Dreidel, and his ruddy, monolithic face softened with amusement. "Why aren't you wearing clothes, Yessarian?" "I don't want to." "What do you mean you don't want to? Why the hell don't you want to?" "I just don't want to, sir." "Why isn't he wearing clothes?" General Dreidel demanded over his shoulder of Colonel Cathcart. "He's talking to you," Colonel Korn whispered over Colonel Cathcart's shoulder from behind, jabbing his elbow sharply into Colonel Cathcart's back. "Why isn't he wearing clothes?" Colonel Cathcart demanded of Colonel Korn with a look of acute pain, tenderly nursing the spot where Colonel Korn had just jabbed him. "Why isn't he wearing clothes?" Colonel Korn demanded of Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren. "A man was killed in his plane over Avignon last week and bled all over him," Captain Wren replied. "He swears he's never going to wear a uniform again." "A man was killed in his plane over Avignon last week and bled all over him," Colonel Korn reported directly to General Dreidel. "His uniform hasn't come back from the laundry yet." "Where are his other uniforms?" "They're in the laundry, too." "What about his underwear?" General Dreidel demanded. "All his underwear's in the laundry, too," answered Colonel Korn. "That sounds like a lot of crap to me," General Dreidel declared. "It is a lot of crap, sir," Yessarian said. "Don't you..."
Interesting. Korn's like, "Let's just bullshit our way through this."
Okay. "Don't you worry, sir," Colonel Cathcart promised General Dreidel with a threatening look at Yessarian. "You have my personal word for it that this man will be severely punished." "What the hell do I care if he's punished or not?" General Dreidel replied with surprise and irritation. "He's just won a medal. If he wants to receive it without any clothes on, what the hell business is it of yours?" "Those are my sentiments exactly, sir," Colonel Cathcart echoed with resounding enthusiasm and mopped his brow with a damp white handkerchief. "But would you say that, sir, even in the light of General Peckham's recent memorandum on the subject of appropriate military attire in combat areas?" "Peckham?" General Dreidel's face clouded. "Yes, sir, said Colonel Cathcart obsequiously. "General Peckham even recommends that we send our men into combat in full-dress uniform so they'll make a good impression on the enemy when they're shot down." "Peckham?" repeated General Dreidel, still squinting with bewilderment. "Just what the hell does Peckham have to do with it?" Colonel Korn jabbed Colonel Cathcart sharply again in the back with his elbow. "Absolutely nothing, sir," Colonel Cathcart responded sprucely, wincing in extreme pain and gingerly rubbing the spot where Colonel Korn had just jabbed him again. "And that's exactly why I decided to take absolutely no action at all until I first had an opportunity to discuss it with you. Shall we ignore it completely, sir?" General Dreidel ignored him completely, turning away from him in baleful scorn to hand Yessarian his medal in its case. "Get my girl back from the car," he commanded Colonel Moody's crabbily, and waited in one spot with his scowling face down until his nurse had rejoined him. "Get word to the office right away to kill that directive I just issued ordering the men to wear neckties on the combat missions," Colonel Cathcart whispered to Colonel Korn urgently out of the corner of his mouth. "I told you not to do it," Colonel Korn snickered, "but you just wouldn't listen to me." "Shh," Colonel Cathcart cautioned. "God damn it, Korn, what did you do to my back?" Colonel Korn snickered again. General Dreidel's nurse always followed General Dreidel everywhere he went, even into the briefing room just before the mission to Avignon, where she stood with her asinine smile at the side of the platform and bloomed like a fertile oasis at General Dreidel's shoulder in her pink and green uniform. Yessarian looked at her and fell in love desperately. His spirit sank, leaving him empty inside and numb. He sat gazing in clammy want at her full red lips and dimpled cheeks as he listened to Major Danby describe in a monotonous, didactic male drone the heavy concentrations of flak awaiting them at Avignon, and he moaned in deep despair suddenly at the thought that he might never see again this lovely woman to whom he had never spoken a word and whom he now loved so pathetically. He throbbed and ached with sorrow, fear, and desire as he stared at her. She was so beautiful. He worshipped the ground she stood on. He licked his parched, thirsting lips with a sticky tongue and moaned in misery again, loudly enough this time to attract the startled, searching glances of the men sitting around him on the rows of crude wooden benches in their chocolate-covered coveralls and stitched white parachute harnesses.
Okay, so this is where the moaning during the briefing? This is the black guy. Yep.
Nately turned to him quickly with alarm. "What is it?" he whispered. "What's the matter?" Yessarian did not hear him. He was sick with lust and mesmerized with regret. General Dreidel's nurse was only a little chubby, and his senses were stuffed to congestion with the yellow radiance of her hair and the unfelt pressure of her soft, short fingers with the rounded, untasted wealth of her nubile breasts in her army pink shirt that was opened wide at the throat, and with the rolling, ripened, triangular confluences of her belly and thighs in her tight, slick, forest-green gabardine officer's pants. He drank her in insatiably from head to painted toenail. He never wanted to lose her. "Oh," he moaned again. And this time the whole room
rippled. Less lifelike, less lifelike. A little less realistic, please. Ooh. It's in context, no.
"Oh." He moaned again, and this time the whole room rippled at his quavering, drawn-out cry. A wave of startled uneasiness broke over the officers on the dais, and even Major Danby, who had begun synchronizing the watches, was distracted momentarily as he counted out the seconds and almost had to begin again. Nately followed Yessarian's transfixed gaze down the long-frame auditorium until he came to General Dreidel's nurse. He blanched with trepidation when he guessed what was troubling Yessarian. "Cut it out, will you?" Nately warned in a fierce whisper. "Oh!" Yessarian moaned a fourth time, this time loudly enough for everyone to hear him distinctly. "Are you crazy?" Nately hissed vehemently. "You'll get into trouble." "Oh!"
"Oh, no!"
Dunbar answered, Yessarian from the opposite end of the room. Nately recognized Dunbar's voice. The situation was now out of control, and he turned away with a small moan. "Oh." "Oh!" Dunbar moaned back at him. "Oh!" Nately moaned out loud in exasperation when he realized that he had just moaned. "Oh!" Dunbar moaned back at him again. "Oh!" Someone entirely new chimed in from another section of the room, and Nately's hair stood on end. Yessarian and Dunbar both replied while Nately cringed and hunted about futilely for some hole in which to hide and take Yessarian with him. A sprinkling of people were smothering laughter. An elfin impulse possessed Nately, and he moaned intentionally the next time there was a lull. Another new voice answered. The flavor of disobedience was titillating, and Nately moaned deliberately again. The next time he could squeeze one in edgewise. Still another new voice echoed him. The room was boiling irrepressibly into bedlam. An eerie hubbub of voices was rising. Feet were scuffled, and things began to drop from people's fingers, pencils, computers, map cases, clattering steel flak helmets. A number of men who were not moaning were now giggling openly. And there was no telling how far the unorganized insurrection of moaning might have gone if General Dreidel himself had not come forward to quell it. Stepping out determinedly in the center of the platform directly in front of Major Danby, who with his earnest, persevering head down, was still concentrating on his wristwatch and saying, 25 seconds, 20, 15. General Dreidel's great, red, domineering face was gnarled with perplexity and oaken with awesome resolution. That will be all, men, he ordered tersely, his eyes glaring with disapproval and his square jaw firm. And that's all there was. I run a fighting outfit, he told them sternly, when the room had grown absolutely quiet, and the men on the benches were all cowering sheepishly. And there'll be no more moaning in this group as long as I'm in command. Is that clear? It was clear to everybody but Major Danby, who was still concentrating on his wristwatch and counting down the seconds aloud. 4, 3, 2, 1, time, called out Major Danby, and raised his eyes triumphantly to discover that no one had been listening to him, and that he would have to begin all over again. Oh, he moaned in frustration. What was that? Roared General Dreidel incredulously, and whirled around in a murderous rage upon Major Danby, who staggered back in terrified confusion and began to quail and perspire. Who is this man? Major Danby, sir, Colonel Cathcart stammered, my group operations officer. Take him out and shoot him, ordered General Dreidel. Sir? I said, take him out and shoot him. Can't you hear? Yes, sir, Colonel Cathcart responded smartly, swallowing hard, and turned in a brisk manner to his chauffeur and his meteorologist. Take Major Danby out and shoot him. Sir? His chauffeur and his meteorologist stammered. I said, take Major Danby out and shoot him, Colonel Cathcart snapped. Can't you hear? The two young lieutenants nodded lumpishly and gaped at each other in stunned and flaccid reluctance, each waiting for the other to initiate the procedure of taking Major Danby outside and shooting him. Neither had ever taken Major Danby outside and shot him before. They inched their way dubiously toward Major Danby from opposite sides. Major Danby was white with fear. His legs collapsed suddenly, and he began to fall. The two lieutenants sprang forward and seized him under both arms to save him from slumping to the floor. Now that they had Major Danby, the rest seemed easy, but there were no guns. Major Danby began to cry. Colonel Cathcart wanted to rush to his side and comfort him, but did not want to look like a sissy in front of General Dreidel. He remembered that Appleby and Havermeyer always brought their 45 automatics on the missions, and began to scan the rows of men in search of them. As soon as Major Danby began to cry, Colonel Moonis, who had been vacillating wretchedly on the sidelines, could restrain himself no longer and stepped out diffidently toward General Dreidel with a sickly air of self-sacrifice. "I think you'd better wait a minute, Dad," he suggested hesitantly. "I don't think you can shoot him." General Dreidel was infuriated by his intervention. "Who the hell says I can't?" he thundered pugnaciously in a voice loud enough to rattle the whole building. Colonel Moonis, his face flushing with embarrassment, bent close to whisper into his ear. "Why the hell can't I?" General Dreidel bellowed. Colonel Moodus whispered some more. "You mean I can't shoot anyone I want to?" General Dreidel demanded with uncompromising indignation. He pricked up his ears with interest as Colonel Moodus continued whispering. "Is that a fact?" he inquired, his rage tamed by curiosity. "Yes, Dad, I'm afraid it is." "I guess you think you're pretty goddamn smart, don't you?" General Dreidel lashed out at Colonel Moodus suddenly. Colonel Moodus turned crimson in it. "No, Dad, it isn't." "All right. Let the insubordinate son of a bitch go," General Dreidel snarled, turning bitterly away from his son-in-law and barking peevishly at Colonel Cathcart's chauffeur and Colonel Cathcart's meteorologist. "But get him out of this building and keep him out, and let's continue this goddamn briefing before the war ends. I've never seen so much incompetence." Colonel Cathcart nodded lamely at General Dreidel and signaled his men hurriedly to push Major Danby outside the building. As soon as Major Danby had been pushed outside, though, there was no one to continue the briefing. Everyone gawked at everyone else in oafish surprise. General Dreidel turned purple with rage as nothing happened. Colonel Cathcart had no idea what to do. He was about to begin moaning aloud when Colonel Korn came to the rescue by stepping forward and taking control. Colonel Cathcart sighed with enormous tearful relief, almost overwhelmed with gratitude. Now, men, we're going to synchronize our watches, Colonel Korn began promptly in a sharp, commanding manner, rolling his eyes flirtatiously in General Dreadle's direction. We're going to synchronize our watches one time and one time only. And if it doesn't come off in that one time, General Dreadle and I are going to want to know why. Is that clear? He fluttered his eyes toward General Dreadle again to make sure his plug had registered.
Okay, so Korn is Dreadle's man and Cathcart is
Peckham's.
Peckham's, and it doesn't quite work that way.
No. Yes. Now set your watches for 9:18. Colonel Korn synchronized their watches without a single hitch and moved ahead with confidence. He gave the men the colors of the day and reviewed the weather conditions with an agile, flashy versatility, casting sidelong, simpering looks at General Dreadle every few seconds to draw increased encouragement from the excellent impression he saw he was making. Preening and pruning himself effulgently and strutting vaingloriously about the platform as he picked up momentum, he gave the men the colors of the day again and shifted nimbly into a rousing pep talk on the importance of the Bridge at Avignon to the war effort and the obligation of each man on the mission to place love of country above love of life. When his inspiring dissertation was finished, he gave the men the colors of the day still one more time, stressed the angle of approach, and reviewed the weather conditions again. Colonel Korn felt himself at the full height of his powers. He belonged in the spotlight. Comprehension dawned slowly on Colonel Cathcart. When it came, he was struck dumb. His face grew longer and longer as he enviously watched Colonel Korn's treachery continue, and he was almost afraid to listen when General Dreadle moved up beside him and, in a whisper, blustery enough to be heard throughout the room, demanded, "Who is that man?" Colonel Cathcart answered with wan foreboding, and General Dreadle then cupped his hand over his mouth and whispered something that made Colonel Cathcart's face glow with immense joy. Colonel Korn saw and quivered with uncontainable rapture. Had he just been promoted in the field by General Dreadle to full colonel? He could not endure the suspense. With a masterful flourish, he brought the briefing to a close and turned expectantly to receive ardent congratulations from General Dreadle, who was already striding out of the building without a glance backward, trailing his nurse and Colonel Mutis behind him. Colonel Korn was stunned by this disappointing sight, but only for an instant. His eyes found Colonel Cathcart, who was still standing erect in a grinning trance, and he rushed over jubilantly to begin pulling on his arm. "What do you say about me?" he demanded excitedly in a fervor of proud and blissful anticipation. "What did General Dreadle say?" "He wanted to know who you were." "I know that, I know that, but what did he say about me? What did he say?" "You make him sick."
So the fact that he's all flourishing and repeating the colors of the day, and yeah. Whereas Dreadle's very much a bullet points man, literally, figuratively. Yeah,
get it done as quickly and succinctly as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, poor Danby would have. But yes. But he was Major Danby, right? Yes,
I
Major
Danby. I believe he was, yeah.
And then we've got Avignon.
Yeah, so we jump back in time in this chapter again, because Avignon had happened when Cathcart was making his list on his desk, but now we jump back to the briefing for Avignon.
I think Avignon might be the core, because we're at the middle of the book, roughly. So Avignon seems to be in the core event that everything else kind of cascades from.
Yeah. Well, we got to experience the moaning.
Yes. 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 That was awkward.
All thanks to General Dreadle's nurse.
General Dreadle's nurse, who he insists attends everything with him all times to torture his son-in-law.
Yep.
But is also affecting everyone else.
And I mean, I think it's pretty perverse, you know. He's trying to force his son-in-law to be unfaithful to his daughter.
Yeah, there's many layers to this, that Dreadle is not a person with any sort of morality or character that's worth having. Like, ugh.
He seems to be, like, it's funny because this is a book of World War II, but it feels like he's old school army, and kind of the way things are going in this war, it's passing him by because he's just doing what he perceives is his job. And
I think he's resentful that he's not a person who's in charge, kind of thing.
Mm.
That seems to be the issue.
Definitely, yeah. I feel like career soldier, he was probably in World War I.
Yeah. Yeah, that
And now, like, whatever was happening in World War One, whatever, however he got to general, it's not cutting it anymore because Peckham's right behind him and Cathcart, like, everyone's scheming and plotting. And he's like, I'm just trying to do my best job, even though his best job is not great.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. But also, I think he's got a very limited, I don't know, there's something about Dreidel that's just, he's just, I think he's frustrated and he's just kind of gone, stuff it. I'm going to do what brings me. I mean, the fact that he's sadistic and manipulative and he's like, everyone, I don't care what they do in their free time, but when I'm giving them orders, I expect them to want to die.
And how he seems to be nastier when sober.
Yes. So I think he's a bit of maybe alcoholic.
Mm.
Possibly. But yes. I'm scared for when we get to know, if we get to know General Peckham.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What do you think that Colonel Cathcart is going to make trouble for Ysarion? Because Ysarion seems, like he said it himself, he thinks Ysarion might be his nemesis.
Yes, but at the same time, he's turning and Khorne keeps... Like he's also remembering that Khorne has hurt him and affected him. So it's not... I think Cathcart sees everyone as potentially his nemesis.
We got that 2 chapters ago. We got a very good look into his mind, but I think this chapter painted him as even worse than we could have imagined.
Well, he's the fact that he's looking at the generals and going, maybe I shouldn't be working with General Dreidel. I should be working with Peckham because Peckham's so much better. And then kind of going, oh, but what if Peckham and I don't actually have an agreement and maybe he isn't what he appears to be?
He really seems incapable of actually settling on a decision, which is why Khorne's been able to take advantage of him so well.
Yeah, he's completely paranoid. And I mean, the tomato situation is after this moment where Khorne may have felt betrayed by Cathcart.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking, Avignon, this whole situation, this briefing, it's all about the fact that, I mean, Ysarion couldn't control himself and his constant attractive women equals quote-unquote love.
Mm-hmm.
His inability to distinguish between love and lust and lack of control versus, and of course, General Dreidel putting that situation on the men.
Mm-hmm.
It's all caused unsettling and big chunks of information would have been missed in that briefing.
Yep.
So, and we know that Avignon was a bit of a disaster.
Yep.
So.
Because the man who knew what was going on was sent out of the room and Khorne was just showboating. So the men probably really didn't even know what they were doing.
No. So it's a mess. And it's all because General Dreidel didn't want, like, it's, I mean, you could argue, is it Ysarion's fault? I know that there's a debates on this. Because you searched Ysarion, one of the first things, like, Ysarion caused everything. You're going, if Avignon is the source of the issues, and this briefing is the flashpoint, so to speak, mm-hmm. Ysarion's lack of control. So Ysarion's lack of control, Danby's lack of ability to be assertive, Cathcart's complete lack of, like, of anything, so he's completely incompetent, Khorne showboating, Dreidel reacting, overreacting, and not being actually aware of what the situation is or what's going on, and introducing the element that is disruptive to the briefing. What the hell does a nurse have to do with a military briefing?
And she was wearing her... her titillating uniform as well.
Yeah. So to do that is unprofessional. And it's also, like, you'd assume that she should not be privy to that information.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing's a mess. Did she even get a name? I don't think she did.
Just the nurse.
Yeah. So far, in terms of women, we've only had names for...
Luciana, is that it?
Luciana, no.
And Debbie does.
Debbie does. Lieutenant Shyskov's wife, sort of.
Well, that's Mrs. what we know her as.
Sort of, yes. That's it. And I think that's almost it.
And the woman that Natalie's been seeing.
Yeah, I think we got her name, but I'm not sure.
No, she's just referred to as Natalie's bleep.
Bleep, yeah. And then there's also the countess or the contessa or whatever, like the people who are living in the building that are apparently well off, but also...
There's incidentals.
And the maid with the green undies and things. Yes. So they don't get names most of the time.
The nurses in the hospital.
There's, I think one of the nurses was named. I'm not sure which one. One of the hospitals, one of the nurses got a name. Mm. But yeah, it's really bad. Like it's really objectification just generally, I think, is the thing. But yes.
And you're right, it was from General Dreidel's perspective, I think, but just when they started describing the nurse, that just threw me, because that was the most blunt language used to objectify women in this book so far.
Yeah, because most of the time it's from the perspective of Viserion.
His love may be misplaced, but he does revere all those he loves after.
Yes, he has a thing for... fixated on women.
Which is why the moaning was especially funny to me. The moaning was not just because he was lusting after the woman. The moaning was that he was about to go off on a mission where he could die and he might never see her again.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, Dunbar and all the other... And then Natalie's just, oh God, no. Giving up. And then some stage she's like, right, I'm getting in on this act.
And then just random people started doing it.
So funny.
Was it Natalie who was like, oh, I don't want to do this? I was like, oh no, I moaned.
Yes, and then Dunbar responded. And then by then everyone's giggling and chuckling and all that. Disturbing that as soon as you say, take the guy out and shoot him, take the major out and shoot him, it's like, he's the briefing officer and you don't have a gun. And so then they're looking around for the people they know have a gun.
Yeah, it's funny how that was such a funny scene and then it got serious so quickly just because of General Dreidel.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts.
Just looking at the next chapter, it's called Milo the Mayor. So he's moving up in the world. And we got a little more about Milo this last chapter.
Yeah, I think he's gone out of control. Yeah. Out of control.
It's just so weird that everyone in this whole company seems to be enthralled to him. And like, why? What? Does he just have this weird charisma that...
Yes, I think he's just... Well, remember, he gives an air of incompetence, but really he's very shrewd.
Yeah, I mean, that got even us. We thought he was stupid. And
yeah.
Then when we got the more information, we're like, oh, no.
Yeah, he's actually a lot more.
Really devious.
Yes, it's definitely something that's beyond just... He gives an impression, but he's actually manipulative and sneaky and wheedly. And we'll find out. We'll find out more, I think, next chapter. But I have a feeling. Yes.
Unless he just gets like a paragraph and we go off in another direction, which the book has done. You know,
which it has done. Yes.
But, I hope you all enjoyed that. The music at the top of the podcast was Soap Runs. It's by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo, that's R-O-O-M-C-M-O-O, on Twitter. You can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast, both on Twitter and Facebook. And if you add @gmail.com, you get our email address.
We love to hear from you. What are you thinking of the podcast so far? Do you like the book? Do you have any suggestions of books you'd like us to read in the future? We will take that under consideration. But in the meantime, we hope you're all doing well. We hope you're all staying safe and holding on to that hope, that any hope you can.
Yeah, it's if you are finding it difficult to see hope out there, try and contribute to creating it. I think that's the message, to try and contribute what you can to bring hope.
Yeah,
it's hard though.
Yes,
it's hard.
that old saying, be the change you want to see.
Well,
be the hope you want to see.
I think it's not necessarily that, like, you can't change the entire world on your own. No, but if you can do things that bring you hope and bring hope to others, then that's change. That inspires change. So there you go. Be the inspiration for change that you would like to see. There you go.
That's not as snappy.
No, but it's probably more.
But we hope you're all doing well, and enjoy your reading, and we'll see you next time.
Yes. Bye.